Welcome to everyone. This is the very first day of Sesshin, and so of course we're in learning mode. All students, and we're all exercising beginner's mind, and we really feel it on the first day. There's no way to avoid it. Please be comfortable with it. There's no need to worry if it isn't working out just right. It never does. I used to go sailing with my husband, and the very first time in the year when we went out, there was always something wrong with the boat. Always. No matter how hard we tried. It's always that way. So no expectations, just be surprised. Let it surprise you and go on from there. So when Dogen was at Aheiji hundreds and hundreds of years ago, he always started and ended a practice period with little talks. And they've been saved. So they're little bits of wisdom all through Koban's teachings, just from his little formal, kind of informal formal talks at the beginning and end of things, or at the new year, or Buddha's birthday. And I recommend them. They're really helpful and interesting to read. And one of them, he talks about at the beginning of practice period and at the end of it, thinking encircles the earth. Karmic consciousness fills the sky. Even so, is it necessary to grasp the key to the gate of going beyond? It is necessary to grasp the key to the gate of going beyond. Just be present 3,000 times in the morning and 800 times at night. At the right moment, be sure not to miss the transmission of the stream. Don't miss it. Pay attention. So this is something that has always been on my mind in terms of practice. What it is to be ordinary people with an ordinary life. Koban called me a housewife, to my great dismay. But it's true, we're all living a householder life of some kind. We're not living in the monastery. In Sesshin, we're not actually living in the monastery, but we're living in conditions where it's possible to practice as if, and to pay attention to the point of how it is that it's not just in the zendo. It's the going out and what happens outside. It's the coming in and what happens inside. So it seems when we begin like we come rushing in, and then we sit down, and then we get into a mind state, and it becomes whatever it becomes, and then we get up and we do bowing, and then we go out, and then we run around and do our stuff. So it gives us a chance here for a week at least to slow down and let our stuff be our practice, whatever that is. Going in and out of the door, taking off our shoes, picking up our chopsticks, or bowing to each other, or bowing to our cushion. That we can do any of those things just like that. And we often do. Oh, and we're off. We've got an agenda. We always have an agenda. And we're in a hurry. We're trying to get somewhere. There's nowhere to get. There's nowhere to get. We're here already. And if we're a tiny bit late, it's not the end of the world, which is such a good thing for all of us. I know the kind of world we live in where it's essential that we have to be on time and people get really upset, but I think it's worth people getting upset to slow down and be a little bit late if you have to. And just let it be like that as part of your life, the way it's living itself, the way it needs to be. Our practice is to face our conditioning. It's a big part of our practice. It's just to sit down and notice how much of what's in our mind has been put there by others. And I used to think that, well, that's true when I'm young, and I'll address that, and I'll see that, and I'll be very rebellious, and I won't do all those things. And then they'll be gone. But the truth is that they're always here. We're always conditioned. So our practice never ends. Our paying attention to what our conditioning is never ends. And that, I wouldn't call it rebellious anymore, but I would say that study, that deep study of what it is that's running us, how we know what we know, and does it feel true? I think we all long to be authentic. And of course, we all learn to create a person to be. And so another part of our practice is to examine that person we have learned to be, the one that we present in the present. Study it and care for it and appreciate it and perhaps see where the flaws are, where a little dishonesty is, or where anxiety lies. There's so much anxiety. The whole of human race is anxious because we're going to die. So from start to finish, we are a little unnerved by being this. It's a very unnerving proposition. And yet, here we are. So facing that anxiety and allowing it to be present as a truth of our life gives us ways of dealing with it that are not automatic or given to us by somebody else. How do we do it? How can we be authentic and honest? When we chant in the morning or at lunch with the Meal Sutra, we chant the names of the Buddhas and the great Bodhisattvas, and one of them is Samantabhadra Bodhisattva, which already is really nice to say, Samantabhadra. And that's the one who goes out into the world riding on an elephant, a great white elephant with many tusks and It's quite remarkable if you read the description in the Lotus Sutra. And the whole of his vow is to be out there with everybody, wherever he goes. That's truly the Bodhisattva vow. So here, in this small, safe place, we can practice this kind of vow so that we can take it out into the greater world. So our bowing is a very big part of this. How we bow and to what we bow. So that it's not a by-the-way thing. It's not just a kind of nod. It doesn't have to be a big deal either. But just to respect, which means to re-see what we see. Spect comes from spectacle and spectacles, and all the spec words are about seeing. And respect means to see it truly. And not just each other, and not just the postman and your boss, but blades of grass and stones and motorcycles, cars. Every single thing is an expression of Dharma. Every single thing is an expression of Buddha. Every single thing is Sangha. Koban always said, all beings are members of our Sangha. So bowing makes this real. It realizes it very simply. It also slows us down a bit, which is a good thing. So then there's the question of service. Because the question comes up, if we're sitting, how shall I do? What can I do? How can I express this? And there's a choice, really, between doing our duty. Oh, I've got this job. I'll do whatever I need to do. Plod, plod, plod. Or fast, fast, fast. Getting it over with and going on to who knows what. Or stopping and really addressing what it is. I realized many years ago when I first was learning how to be a priest, if there is such a thing, as learning to be a priest, but bumbling around the altar, I didn't get it at first. And why did the priest get to be the only one at the altar? And why is it like this? And what is a service anyway? And there was one moment when I suddenly realized that everything we do is serving it. We call it Buddha, we call it Dharma, we call it Sangha, because we don't know how to call it. We don't know how to say. But we know. So everything we do can be service. This was especially meaningful to me when Wendy, who is not here today, she's coming Monday, began to sign her emails to me in service. And I thought, oh, I was so touched. It's what we're all doing in service to the welfare of, to the care of, to the well-being of whatever we're encountering, wherever we are. It's the bodhisattva way, we call it, but it's ordinary life. So the reason I figure that the priest gets to serve the altar is because the priest has such a huge responsibility that she has to prostrate completely under the eye of Buddha in total humility again and again. Otherwise, it can turn into something unhealthy. And we've seen it many times. It's very easy to have a position that looks like it's elevated. Although the truth is, priesthood is a stepping down, as Koban always said. It's stepping down to be with everybody. It's agreeing to be with everybody, in front of everybody. So that's why the priest has to serve the altar every time to offer up her own small life for the sake of the big one. And there's no end to that. So there are a few things I want to mention about the meals. The water and the food offerings might seem strange to some of you who are new to this. And they seem strange to me until sitting in this very zendo many years ago, a Native American friend of ours who was helping us create this place was leaning against the door jamb and watching us offer food on the end of our setsus. And then the gathering up of the food and taking it out. And afterwards I said, oh, maybe you think this is a little strange. And he said, oh, no, we do that. Of course. I know what you're doing. It's deep in us, our connection to everything. And our respect for even the life we can't see, that we know is all around us, teeming around us. And so we take that respect out there and offer a little recognition of that. And the water the same. We wash our bowls in order to be hygienic, drink our water because it's nice and clean, it's ours, and then we offer it. Give it away. Is that not cool or what? So there are a few small things about the logistics. One is that Teen Hin has put it at the end before lunch and dinner so that you can go and take care of bathroom needs before the meal. So you don't have to go as you're going up to eat, so that people can just straight away gather at the table. So that's one way we kind of organize this. The Kaisando, which is this outside room, is for those who come in late and everyone's already sitting or walking, you can join the sitting or the walking in the Kaisando. It's not necessary to come in while the sitting or the walking is going on. And the other thing is stretching. I think I've seen people stretch. I think it's important to stretch where you're not visible to, especially to people sitting or walking. But I think it's important to do it. And everybody has a space in which to sleep, in which there probably is room to do some stretching. And I was wondering if the small Zendo is available. Do you know, Mike?
I don't think it's booked.
So people could use the little Zendo right across there and do some yoga. It helps so much. This is such a physical thing to do. And it requires a lot of us. So whatever we can do to help it, it's really important to do. So Dogen said, we aspire and practice within timelessness. When timelessness is realized, you are alive. Other questions? Comments?
I'd be encouraged to hear the opening of the poem. Was that, I wasn't clear whether it was Dogen who's...
It was Dogen.
...the 800?
Yes. Karen?
This might be a good time to ask. When you are doing your prostration during the ceremony, when we're in floating Zendo, we do this with you. Mm-hmm. Do we do it with you here, or I'm a little bit confused about that?
The second set, the first set we do together, the second set is because the priest needs more. And so you all can stand and wait while she does it some more.
First set we can do with you.
First set. Okay. And the last set.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I appreciated so much of what you said, and I appreciated the comments about humility as well. And I'm curious about the role of emotion in Zen. I had kind of an emotional summer, and I did some really deep kind of emotional excavating, and it kind of like felt like it took me over in a deep, challenging way, and it's still like the taps kind of can open, and there's all this pain, emotional pain, and I've been practicing Zen for so long, and the openings have been so incredible and deep and sometimes really long. And yet, God, when I sat down to do some of this excavating work, there was so much material there. And I'm just curious about, you know, I guess like the potential for spiritual bypass. I think that concept of spiritual bypass kind of dovetails with what you're saying about humility, and that sometimes I think that the emotion that can be stored in people can actually end up informing you know, words and actions in a way that's harmful, even if there's all of this realization. And so I'm just in a place of, like, I guess some confusion around, you know, whole living within Zen and really ahimsa, like really the practice of non-harming.
Our suffering helps us understand other people's suffering. Because it happens everywhere. You can practice Zen till the cows come home, but that doesn't stop suffering in the sense that you're talking about. There are endless disappointments. There's lots of anger and misery in our life as human beings. That's how we're made. But Zazen gives us a way to be with it, to be selfless with it. We can experience it, but we don't have to identify with it. So that when my granddaughter didn't talk to me for weeks and months, it felt terrible. And yet life went on. And I could have stopped and made it an issue, but it wouldn't have helped. So the point is to find out what's helpful. There are a lot of emotions that we feel that we just indulge ourselves because they're there. But if they're helpful, we study them and experience them and try to understand what's happening. But to cultivate them is a mistake. And it's very easy. I felt when I was waiting for Sophie and she wasn't there, that I could start cultivating a whole story about why she wasn't there and what I should do and all of those things. And I just realized I didn't have to do that. And it was such a good idea because it wasn't a problem, really, unless I wanted to make it a problem. Some things really are a problem and we need to address them. But we need to look carefully at whether they're really a problem or something else that's going on. We're also very devoted, some of us anyway, including myself, to drama. When things happen, we can make a kind of exciting story about it and then start living the story and believing it. So examine your beliefs and see if they're true. Often they're not, in my experience. Many ideas that turn out, oh, that wasn't the way it was at all. What was I thinking? So that's what Dogen means by studying the self. It's not some big, heavy-duty thing. It's about really paying attention and seeing what's going on. And it also means getting help if you need help. Because sometimes emotions are overwhelming, and it's very helpful to have someone who understands sort of technically how it works in the human mind. That's very helpful sometimes. It's a very good question.
I was curious about what the line is between, you know, like emotional healing or trauma release and propagating state. Because what I did this summer was, I mean, in terms of everything I've learned in Zen, it was like a huge, like, field day for self-image, you know? But I wanted to undertake it because I was like, okay, there's stuff that's there, you know? And I want, you know, the psychology, the personality to be free of that stuff. And in all the Zen practice, you know, I was able to lift it up and see, ooh, my Pandora's box is suddenly there. Whereas I could be like so Zen, sit every day,
that's not Zen,
and talk about it in the Bay Area TEDx or whatever, you know, and it's all like mindful, you know. But then I don't know, it just seems like there's this other piece, like not like when you sit you don't feel, but I'm just so curious about that line between propagating state.
Well, the states you're describing, the Zen states you're describing, are the ones that when you go to the teacher, he says, that's lovely. Now, sit some more.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of states pass through our bodies and our minds. But you'll know when the real meaning is true. And it's not, if it isn't helping you, it's not real.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been real at the moment, but that's not Zen.
Mm-hmm.
That's just something that happens. That's why we continue to sit. It's not a one-time deal or a 10-time deal. It's all day, every day. Yes.
Thank you, Angie. I like what you said about slowing down and having the time, like luxury, to observe our conditioning in every small moment.
Yes.
Stepping through the door, dipping a teacup. And both for me and I think for our society, we're much more the bodhisattva vow of being with others.
Yes.
Of showing up. So, you know, my life is this tug of war. And it's actually very easy for me to sort of be in the monastic space.
Mm-hmm.
But I find myself, as an adult, making decisions that keeps me in the world and, you know, desire to help people.
Yes. Yes.
But a part of me feels that it's not necessarily what I really want.
Well, that's the lure of this practice, that it can give us this luxury. And that's not what it's for. I certainly felt that when I had three little boys at home and I really wanted to go to Tassajara and just throw myself into the practice. And I couldn't do it. So it takes figuring out where it lies, where the crunchy place is, because it's in you. It's about your commitment to yourself, really. How you find that place where you can do both, be both. Actually, there isn't a both. It's the same yin. Yeah, find that one. It's a good question.